But it's been awesome to be together already this morning. I've found just what we've sung, what we've reflected on from the scriptures already has caused me to reflect on the amazing grace that God has shown to me. And already I feel moved. I feel moved within for the grace that God has shown to me, and I hope you do too. There's a man by the name of John Newton who lived in the 18th century. His mum died when he was seven. When he was 11, he was taken to sea by his dad. He had a fairly rough sort of time over many years. He eventually became the captain of his own vessel. He was a captain of a slave trading ship. And he was a rough man, a man who would have said he was far from God, a foul-mouthed man, and a man who traded slaves. One night he's on his ship and a violent storm came up, so violent that it crushed a hole in the side of the ship and it was filling with water. And so he cried out to God. His mother had been a God-fearer, and so he cried out to God, "God, please save me." Now, God answered that prayer. The waves shifted the boat, the cargo in the hold shifted and plugged up the hole, and the ship stopped filling with water and eventually drifted to shore, and he was saved. Now, he saw that as such a profound thing that it made him start to investigate Christianity. He started to read the Bible, he started to read Christian literature, and over time he came to the point where he realised that God could forgive a man like him, that God could show grace to a man like him, foul-mouthed, far from God, someone who traded slaves. And he was so profoundly changed by that, he became a Christian. He went on to become a Christian minister. He went on to support William Wilberforce in his great goal to abolish slavery in England, and they did that. And as a minister, John Newton wrote a number of songs, and the most famous song that he wrote is Amazing Grace. Now, we've got a slide with it just very, very light down the bottom and small down the bottom. But it goes like this, the first verse, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see." Now, they're famous words. They're words that pretty much every Christian knows, but many who aren't familiar with church things know. It's a famous, perhaps the most famous Christian song. And these are John Newton's words because they're John Newton's story. He truly felt that he was a wretch who God had shown amazing grace to, who had opened his eyes so he could see, who had found him and drawn him near and drawn him back to God. But I think that this song, this hymn, has been so popular for Christians throughout the centuries because it's our song, isn't it? It's our story. It's my story. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And that's every Christian story. And as Tim said, we're going to sing it together at the end, which is great. Here's some other famous words about grace. These words are written by a man who thought he was close to God, but like John Newton, was far from God. Saul of Tarsus, a Jew, a religious zealot of Jesus' day. He thought Jesus was a blasphemer, a dead blasphemer, rightly crucified and executed. And he thought that all Christians were liars, proclaiming that Jesus had risen from the dead. And so he went around persecuting Christians, trying to destroy the church, throwing Christians into prison and murdering Christians. But he met the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus, was forgiven by Jesus, and he too became a Christian, a follower of Jesus. And he became one of Jesus' greatest ambassadors and became to be known as the Apostle Paul. And he writes these words, "For it is by grace you have been saved, through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast." See, he too understands the amazing grace of God. In fact, John Newton, when he wrote his song, probably was reflecting on some of these words and others of Paul's words about amazing grace. What we're going to do is spend some time looking at these words of the Apostle Paul, particularly around four headings, four words: grace, saved, faith, works. Firstly, grace. What is grace? Well, grace is a beautiful word. A beautiful word. It's such a beautiful word that we gave our first daughter the middle name Grace. We figured we couldn't call her first name Grace because our last name is Fuller, so it'd be Grace Fuller. Then we'd have to go, second child Beauty, Beautifuller, and then third child son Dread, Dreadfuller. That We steered clear from that, though, and went with first name, Grace Fuller, because we think it's just such a beautiful word, grace. The concept behind it is beautiful. But what does it mean? Because pretty much the only place you hear the word these days is when someone says, "Let's say grace," meaning let's give thanks to God for the food before eating. But what grace means, most simply, is this: generosity. Generosity. And I do the mental substitution. Every time I read the word grace in a sentence or hear it somewhere, I do the mental substitution. That means generosity. You can do it with a song, Amazing Grace. Amazing generosity. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. You can do it with this verse: for it is by generosity that you have been saved. Generosity. Now, straight away for me, that makes things much, much clearer. When we're speaking about God's grace towards us, we're speaking about God's amazing generosity towards us. And because God's generosity is just so profound, so big, so wonderful, so giving, so overwhelming, so incredible, so generous, it usually gets called amazing. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Now, we could probably come up with other words. We could call it incredible grace. Incredible grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Now, it doesn't quite roll off the tongue. Overwhelming. When you hear of the grace of God, it's the sort of generosity that should overwhelm you. Overwhelming generosity. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. But none of those roll off the tongue very well. The one I really like is crazy grace. Crazy grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Now, I think that rolls off the tongue. And you get a sense with crazy of God's grace is so amazing, so incredible, so profound. It's just crazy. It's almost absurd that God would be that generous towards us. But crazy grace sounds like it could be a person. So let's just stick with amazing. God's grace, his amazing grace is so incredible, so mind-blowing, so crazy. It's just over the top. I don't know if anyone has ever given you a gift that you just thought, this is just over the top generosity. Imagine someone gives you a house. Imagine someone gives you $5 million. Just gives it to you. It would be such a great, overwhelming gift. You'd probably be speechless. But God has given a greater gift than even that. Greater than a house. Greater than $5 million. He has given us the greatest thing that he could possibly ever give, that could possibly ever be given. He has given us salvation. Salvation from a terrible fate. Salvation to a relationship with him. See, what is the greatest thing that the beautiful, wonderful, true, holy, kind, good, generous God could ever give anyone? Himself. And so in his incredible grace, he gives himself to us, saves us from a terrible situation, saves us for a relationship with himself. It's a massive, overwhelming, beautiful gift. And it's given to people who are totally undeserving, which is the other component of grace. Grace means that the person who receives it, the recipient of the grace, is undeserving. Now, you get that from that sense from the way we use the word gracious today. When someone shows grace, they are gracious. Now, not graceful. That's a different word. If I was to show you how graceful I was, then I'd dance across the stage, I'd do a couple of pirouettes, I'd finish with a demi-plié. I hope that's not a rude thing, whatever a demi-plié is. And I'd be so graceful, you'd just say, oh, you're so graceful. But this is gracious. When someone is gracious, it means that when someone's done you wrong, instead of treating them the way that they deserve, you treat them with generosity instead. Imagine this. You're a waiter or a waitress. You're carrying someone's meal to them. They've been waiting a long time. It's a business lunch. The kitchen has been slow. It's already a problem. You're bringing it out. You rush. You trip. The meal flies out of your hand, bounces across the table and lands in their lap. Now, you can imagine the response might be, rightly, upset, some sort of anger. They might say, we're done here. We're leaving. I'm never going to eat here again. And they go. But imagine this. Imagine if they spoke kindly to you. Imagine if they said things like, oh, I understand, these things happen. Imagine if they allowed you to go away, prepare another meal, and when you brought the other meal back and placed it before them, they said thank you. Not sarcastically, not rudely, they actually genuinely said thank you for the meal that you brought back to them. And when they left a tip. And not just a tip, actually quite a sizable tip. Now you'd think, wow, that was gracious, wasn't it? They didn't treat me the way I deserved. I mucked up. I stuffed up. I didn't deserve to be treated well. And yet they didn't treat me the way I deserved. In fact, they treated me with incredible generosity. Generosity to the undeserving. Now, that's grace. And that's a very small example from life. And it's a beautiful thing when we see it in life. Here's another example. If you've read the book Les Mis, or seen the movie, or been to the musical, or watched the movie that is the musical, or it just keeps rolling out. There's multiple incarnations. It's a wonderful story, and it keeps being retold because it's a story about things like love and sacrifice and grace. Now, towards the beginning of the book, there's an episode of grace that changes the main character's life, Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean is a man who has been sent to prison for stealing food to feed, I think, his sister's kids, stealing bread. He goes to prison a couple of times, he tries to escape, and so he's there 19 years in prison. When he's freed, he's no longer a young man, and he has to go around carrying a yellow passport, which means he's a criminal. So everywhere he goes, every job he tries to get, every place he tries to stay, he has to show his passport, which says criminal, ex-criminal. And so where he goes, he can't get a job. He can't find a place to stay. He goes from door to door, house to house, can't find anyone to take him. That is until he goes to the Christian bishop's house, a kindly old bishop who says, come in, welcomes him into his home, feeds him a hearty meal, gives him a bed to sleep in. Jean Valjean repays this by waking in the night, stealing the silver cutlery, stealing the silver bowls, and running off. Now, the next morning, the police have caught Jean Valjean, and they bring him before the bishop, and they say, we caught this man with your silver cutlery and your silver bowls in his bag. He says that you gave these to him as a gift. And the bishop, almost without blinking, says, yes. Yes, why yes? And Jean Valjean, I am very angry with you. Why did you not take the candlesticks as well? Let's fetch the candlesticks. Take these. And he gives them to Jean Valjean and says something like, with these I've bought for you a new life. Live it for God. And it changes the rest of Jean Valjean's life. Here is a bishop, kind and generous, invites Jean Valjean in. Jean Valjean takes advantage, steals from him, deserves punishment. He's brought back, and the bishop not only shows him mercy, lets him off the punishment, but grace, generosity. Take the candlesticks as well. Riches to this man. Start a new life, a whole new life. We are Jean Valjean. We have been shown such kindness and generosity by God that he has made us, that he has designed us, that he has given us our friends, our family, our life, this world, the things we enjoy, all that is good given to us by him. And after being shown that kindness by God, we ignore him, refuse to obey him, refuse to honour him, treat him as if he wasn't even worthy of thinking much about him. And so we deserve punishment for that wrong, but instead of punishing us, God shows us not just mercy in his son Jesus, that we can be forgiven of the crime, but grace. God says, take the candlesticks as well. Not only do I forgive you by the death of my son, I make you my child. I bring you into my heavenly kingdom. I give you complete and utter forgiveness for all this life. I give you purpose and hope and meaning, and my love is upon you. God's grace to us is amazing. It's amazing not just because the gift that he gives, salvation, relationship with him is so great, but because also we are so undeserving as people of that gift. Second word, saved. Is by grace you have been saved. God in his incredible generosity has saved us. And you think, well, saved from what? Now, I've mentioned a little bit about what we have been saved from. But if you look at your sheets that was read to us just before I jumped up, in verse 4, it gives us another little picture, another little image to show us what we have been saved from. Verse 4, it says, we were dead in our transgressions. Now, transgress is to cross the line. God, in his word, has clearly marked a line in the sand saying, this is how I require you to live. This is the sort of love and kindness and generosity you are to have towards others. And these are the sort of things that would violate that love and kindness and generosity towards others. So don't do that. Don't cross those lines. These are the sort of ways that you relate to me as God in thankfulness and obedience and love. And these are the sort of things that would violate that. If you were to step across those lines, don't step across the line. But the problem is, according to that verse, we're transgressors. We're line crossers. We keep unintentionally and intentionally stepping over the lines that God has laid down for us. We fail to live the way God requires of us. We fail to live even the way that we know is right within ourselves. We've failed to do the things we know to be right, and we've done the things we know to be wrong. And it says there that we're not just transgressors, but that we're actually dead in our transgressions. It's not just that we've stepped across the line a few times in our life. It's that we've actually carked it and died over the line, and we're now living in the world of transgression. We're trapped in our disobedience to God and His ways, and dead people can't do anything. They can't get up. They can't get back across the line. They can't make up for things. Dead people are dead. We are dead in our transgressions, trapped in crossing the line against what God requires of us. Our natural stance towards God is not, as we would suppose, warmth. Our natural stance towards God is rather coldness, rejection, going our own way. In the Isaiah passage that was read to us earlier, I don't think we read these words, but in there are these words. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. We've each turned to his own way. Now, I don't know much about sheep, but I know what's being said here. It's pretty clear. We've all run off from God. We've all gone our own way and chosen our own path. We've all stopped following him and obeying him. We all want to be the boss of ourselves and go our own way. We, you, me, all of us, every one of us has turned away from the living God as if we were the most important thing and pushed him into the background, focused on ourselves and stepping over the line of God's requirements. And so we stand under God's just judgment. In your passage there, it says, under his wrath, his just anger for the things that we have done wrong. We all need to be saved from our transgressions, but more than that, we need to be saved for the punishment of our transgressions. Now, with most people, if you do them wrong, they'll pay you back. Or, at very best, you do them wrong and they'll write you off. They don't want anything more to do with you. But not God. In his amazing grace, in spite of all this, God himself came to our world. God the Son became a human being while remaining fully God, Jesus. God himself, rather than withdrawing from us, in his grace drew near to us, came near to each one of us. God entered into our pain, entered into our mess, did not stand at a distance because he loves us so much that he would not let us go. Amazing generosity to the undeserving. But more than that, we've been seeing it this morning. Jesus came knowing he would die. Jesus came in order that he would die a horrific death in order to save us. If you'd been there all those thousands of years ago on that Good Friday and you had the eyes to see, you would have seen God flogged, the skin being flayed from his back, God beaten and bruised by the soldiers, mocked and a crown of thorns jammed upon his head, forced to march through the streets carrying his own implement of death, the crossbeam of the cross, nails driven through his wrists, through his feet, the hands that formed the universe, crushed by nails. God himself lifted up, naked and humiliated, to asphyxiate and die for you and me. But more than that, Jesus came knowing that in his death he was actually standing under the judgment of God for the things that we had done wrong. That he stepped into our place and stood under the wrath of God for our transgression, for our wrong. The anger of the just judge for all the world against all the wrong that all people had ever done poured full strength upon his son, and Jesus experienced that. Jesus did that in our place to save us. Save us from that fate, to draw us into a relationship with his Father, with God. Jesus takes the punishment that you and I deserve for rejecting God, sinning against God, transgressing against God. We have been saved by grace. Saved from the punishment of being shut off from a relationship with God now and forever by God's incredible generosity that he would come and take the punishment for us so we can live forever in relationship with him. Now, amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saves a wretch like me. This grace is amazing because it is the biggest gift possible, saved for a relationship with God. It is paid for by the most incredible cost, the life of the Son of God the Son, and is totally undeserving. It is to wretches like me, wretches like you. If you've seen the Angelina Jolie movie Unbroken, it's an incredible story about Louis Zamperini. He was an Italian-American. He grew up in California. He was different from the blonde-haired kids, and so he got beaten up. He became a drinker, violent, stole, fought. But he found running, And he found he was very good at running. And he trained and he trained. He eventually became a great athlete who would go on to the Berlin Olympic Games and come eighth. However, before he could take his Olympic ambitions further, training for the next Olympics, World War II broke out. Louis became a bomber pilot fighting the Japanese over the Pacific, but he was shot down over the Pacific. Most of the crew killed, three survived, and he spent 47 days floating at sea in a life raft, fighting off sharks, storms, staying alive by eating the meagre rations they have, catching birds, catching fish, eating them raw. Two Americans survived, one died during that time. They washed up on a Japanese island, though in the movie they're saved by a Japanese boat. But they're taken as prisoners, immediately questioned, brutally mistreated, but they gave up no information. Louis then is sent to a concentration camp in Japan, where he spends the next 2 years brutally mistreated, beaten, terribly. There was this particular Japanese corporal they called the Bird, who had a particular dislike for Louis. Louis was an American, he was an Olympian, and so he wanted to break this man. And so the Bird ordered terrible things done to him. And the movie is about how through all that, Louis stands. He will not betray his country. He will not be broken down by the Bird and the mistreatment he receives. Towards the end of the movie, the Bird forces Zamperini to hold a massive chunk of wood, over his shoulders. And if he dropped it, he was to be executed, shot. But Zamperini, emaciated, withered, holds it by sheer willpower, unbroken. And then the American army arrives, they're liberated, and he is able to go home. This is the story of a man who is unbroken by the worst inhumane treatment that people could give out. He stands in that movie as a testimony to the human spirit. But you know what's even more amazing? The story of when he comes home, which you don't get to see in the movie. When Zamperini comes home, he marries his wife, his childhood sweetheart. He has two kids, all seems wonderful. He has money, he receives insurance money in his back pay for the time while he was in prison. He's a celebrity, he is an Olympian who is a survivor of a prisoner of war camp come home. And so he goes on speaking tours, he's popular. And then it all spirals out of control. He begins drinking heavily, partying, womanizing, he spirals into selfishness and cynicism and greed and alcoholism. He loses his money. He breaks his promises to God. Now, when he was on that raft, when he was in the prison, he cried out, "God, if you will save me, I will serve you for the rest of my life." But he forgot that as soon as he was safe. He was filled with anger, anxiety, depression, and hatred, constantly concocting plans of how he would get back to Japan and murder the Bird for the wrong that he had done him. Louis Zamperini was broken, not unbroken, but not broken by externals and the things that people did to him, though those had a big toll on him. Broken inside, like all of us. He was a transgressor. He turned far from God. He'd wandered away, and he couldn't get out. He needed saving. It got to the point where his wife threatened divorce if he wouldn't go along to a Billy Graham crusade, the great Christian evangelist who died only a few weeks ago. He went the first night and it filled him with such anger that he refused to return, but his wife gave him the ultimatum and persuaded him to come one last time. And that night he heard about a God who is so generous, so gracious, that he forgives all wrongs. He gives salvation to any who will come to him. He changes you so that no longer is hate in your heart, but you can actually start to forgive others. In fact, that's why Jesus came to earth to die in order that we could be forgiven and brought back to God. That night, Zamperini gave his life to Jesus and he became a Christian. He went home, he poured his alcohol down the drain, and he started a new life as a child of God. Zamperini, a dedicated businessman, quit and started running Christian outdoor camps and programs for underprivileged boys. And he went back to Japan and looked his Japanese captors in the eye and personally forgave each and every one of them. He looked for the Bird. He couldn't find him. He was told he was dead and so instead wrote him a letter saying that I forgive you and I wish that you would become a Christian too. For Zamperini, amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost but now I'm found, was blind but now I see. God in his amazing grace has given us the gift of salvation. And later in the verse, you can see there, it says, this is not from yourselves, it's the gift of God. It's a gift, totally a gift. God has done it all and just gives salvation to us as a gift. And like all gifts, you need to accept it, which brings us to the third word, faith. It is by grace you've been saved through faith. Faith is how we receive the gift. But what is faith? Well, again, it's a very misunderstood word. People think it means something like believing in something there is absolutely no evidence for, or believing the unbelievable. But that's not what the Bible means by faith. The Bible means rather trusting the trustworthy. Faith just means trust. Just as I substitute generosity for grace in my mind every time I see grace in the Bible, every time I see faith in the Bible, I do the mental adjustment and I just put in place trust. Trust, that's what faith is. And the important thing is who you trust or what you trust. Don't trust a dodgy broken chair to sit on it because it's going to go bad. Don't trust a provenly crooked and lying investment advisor who wants your money. Don't trust them. Don't trust the cricket player with the yellow... That's a bit harsh, isn't it? If the thing or the person isn't trustworthy, we shouldn't trust them. But if they are trustworthy, if they always come through, you can trust them. I find that the people I find most easily to trust are the ones who don't lie to me. The one who keep coming through on their promises. They're good to their word. My trust is rewarded constantly because I trust trustworthy people. What God has done to save us in his generosity through Jesus is totally trustworthy. This is the God who never lies, never breaks his promises. And if he says that this saves, then it does save. And all we need to do is trust. We don't do anything to be saved. We trust what he has done, what God has done. In his gracious act of coming to die to save us, trust that and you are saved. You know, think about a chair. How do you show that you trust a chair? Well, you entrust yourself to it. You sit on it. You don't do any of the work of holding yourself up. You're not holding yourself up. The chair today is holding you up. All you did was entrusted yourself to the chair by sitting on it. The chair took all the weight. What does it mean to trust in Jesus? You trust that he has done all the work. He is the one who has brought salvation, not us. You just trust that that is the case. God in his generosity has done it all, done everything to save us. We can totally trust him because he always keeps his word. So entrust yourself to him. Which brings us to the final word, works. It is by grace you've been saved through faith, and it is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. Do you see the contrast that's been drawn here? On the one hand, there's the gift of salvation received by trust. On the other hand, there's work for your salvation. On the one hand, it's a free gift. Just receive it by trusting it. On the other hand, it's you need to earn your salvation. You need to be better. You need to be more good. You need to be more religious. You need to do more rituals. You need to go to church. You need to pray more. You need to make up for your wrongs. You need to go to confession. You need to whatever it is that you think God wants of you. Every other religion in this world is at its core this. Earn your salvation. You do it. You do stuff to make yourself acceptable to God. You do stuff to earn your salvation. You do stuff to earn your relationship with God. You do stuff to earn your life after death. But that is not Christianity. The Apostle Paul is absolutely emphatic here. And this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. Not by us working. We cannot earn it. We cannot make up for the wrong things we have done. If the police pull you over for drunk driving, and you've spent the last week obeying the speed limit, or you're going to spend the next week obeying the speed limit, they don't let you off your drunk driving because of your great track record in obeying the speed limit last week or what you're going to do in the week to come. No, you have to receive the punishment for the crime that you have committed. All the things that we have done wrong, the ways that we have stepped across the line, must be punished by the just judge of all the world, God, the only just judge. Otherwise, it would be unfair, unloving in the extreme to all those who have been wronged. Otherwise, God himself would not be just, which is just not possible. We can't make up for the things that we've done wrong. And even if we tried, we could never be good enough, moral enough, loving enough. We constantly fail. We're broken people. We cannot earn our salvation. Do you remember the Beaconsfield miners? Trapped a kilometre underground. In the wreckage of their machinery, that's all that's protecting them. The roof was rubble and sort of giving way. The rescuers realised we need to build another shaft to get down to them. And so they're tunneling through solid rock, blasting, tunneling through solid rock. It took 2 weeks. Imagine that, 2 weeks trapped underground. Now, how cruel would it have been to go to them and say, dig, guys. Save yourselves. Get yourselves out. You can do it. Just work harder. That wasn't possible. What it needed was someone from the outside. Rescuers who weren't trapped to come from above and come and save them, not by their works, but by the work of the rescuers on their behalf. It just wasn't possible any other way. Now that's us. We need saving from the outside. We need saving from God himself, from above, to come to us and rescue us, not by our work, but by the work of Jesus. That's what God in his amazing generosity has done for us, not by works so that no one can boast. We didn't do anything to save ourselves. God in his crazy generosity has done it all. We just received the gift by trusting in what he has done. So we can't boast. We didn't do anything. Rather, it should make Christians incredibly humble people and incredibly thankful people. Incredibly humble because we didn't do anything. God did it all to save us. And incredibly thankful because God did it all to save us, sacrificing for us, which is one of the reasons why we sing. And we're going to spend a bunch of time singing together. Let's pull it all together. For it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. God in his incredible generosity has saved us by the death of Jesus on the cross in our place that Easter Friday all those years ago. It's a gift. And all we need to do is accept the gift by trusting. Jesus paid the punishment. Jesus has done the work. It's not from ourselves. It's not by working. No one can boast. It's all the generosity of God. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. And that's the sort of thing that every Christian sings. I'm a wretch, but I've been saved. By God's amazing generosity and his generosity alone, not by me. I trust him. That's the heart of Good Friday. Let's pray. Oh, Father, we are so thankful for your incredible generosity to us, that you would save wretches like us, that he has done it all, your son Jesus done it all, has paid such a cost so that we could be saved for a relationship with you, be your children now and for all eternity. Please help us to trust your son, to be humble people who know you've done it all, to be thankful people whose hearts are filled with joy and praise today and every day and all day, that we would honour you. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.